Welcome back, young scientists. I'm Dr. Universe, and if you're anything like me, you've got lots of big questions about our world. As a science cat, I have a complicated relationship with birds. I sometimes can't help my instinct to chatter at them through my office window. Maybe that's why I was so excited to talk with my friend, Jennifer Phillips. She studies animal behavior, and she told me all about what it's like to study birds in the field. But first, we talked about sensory pollution. I can't wait for you to hear all about it. Let's get started. You know, we think of pollution and think, oh, pollution is like trash in the river, you know, not so much things that affect your senses.
Yes, exactly. Exactly that. You know, we're used to having pollution be something we can see. Even air pollution, you know, when it's really bad air pollution, you can see the smog in the sky. But sensory pollution is something that interferes with how us or animals sense the world around them. So it's not a visual thing a lot of the time, although it can be. Light pollution is one type of sensory pollution. And then noise pollution is the other main one that I study, at least. It's invisible, but you can sense it with your hearing, right? And that's one sense that a lot of animals rely on, even more so than maybe humans do. So when we put noise into the environment, we're affecting how they perceive their world around them.
You found that some birds were adapting their eyes, like their eyes were adapting to deal with the light pollution. Is that right?
We can't say the mechanism per se, but we studied eye size across the city of San Antonio, which has a really bright and noisy urban core. And as you get towards the outskirts of town, it's not as bright and not as noisy typically when you have more green space. And birds that lived in the brighter urban core had smaller eye size. And the birds that lived more on the outskirts had slightly larger eyes. So there could be a few different mechanisms at work here, right? So there could be selection over time for smaller eyes, and that would support something that we call the protection hypothesis. So if you're a bird living in a very bright area, if your eyes are too big and it's bright all the time, that's going to be annoying, right? Like, yeah. If you're trying to sleep at night or even just be moving about in the like crepuscular times of day at dawn and dusk, you don't want to be blinded all the time. So there might be some selective benefit of having smaller eyes in those types of environments. So it is possible, if there is an actual benefit over time, to see, yeah, selection for smaller eyes. And that's certainly possible. And we only found that in our resident birds that live in San Antonio year round. So cardinals and Carolina wrens, they live there year round. So they're there during the breeding season and they stay pretty much on the same territories, even, you know, in wintertime. They might range a little bit farther to go find food in winter. But basically, that kind of supports that idea potentially of this longer term process. There's also a possibility of, you know, birds with smaller eyes just do better in the city. So when these birds leave their nest, the ones with smaller eyes are more successful in these urban areas, and birds with the bigger eyes that might try to set up a territory don't do as well. So they might just keep moving on until they find a dark area. So it could be sort of self-selection, right? So we don't know for sure, but there's certainly an interesting pattern there no matter what. And I guess the fact that we didn't find any change in eye size or differences in eye size for species that are not there year round, the painted bunting and white-eyed vireo, that suggests potentially you need to be in an area long enough for this type of phenotypic difference to show up.
So the two options are that it's possible the birds that have the smaller eyes are a little bit better fit for where they're living. And so then they are more likely to have babies who also have the small eyes.
Yes.
Or maybe birds with bigger eyes are more bothered by all the light, so they just take off to places that have a little bit less light.
Exactly. So this is an example of what we might expect as an urban phenotype change related to sensory pollution. And that's one question I'm really interested in, and my future work is going to continue to look at as related to both noise and light.
Is it correct that a phenotype is what we can see, whereas a genotype is what is in your DNA?
Exactly. Yeah. So phenotype is what we can see on the outside, and it's being caused by some sort of genotype, typically. For a field biologist like myself, where we go out and measure the birds, it's much easier, at least to me, to get a phenotype. But you can take blood samples and do genotypes as well and look for patterns. But we've got a lot of genes, and so do animals. So you have to be really good at lab work, and you have to figure out basically the whole genome and have some baseline data to really figure out which gene's doing what. And a lot of things are regulated by more than one gene. So that's an approach, actually, I'm taking with my collaborator, who's more of a physiologist and geneticist.
When you were studying those birds, for example, the cardinals, and did you say they were wrens?
Yeah, Carolina wrens.
What did the field work look like? What did you get to do?
So anytime I'm doing a study with birds, typically that means we're going to be getting up really early in the morning and trying to figure out where these birds have their territories. So I typically study breeding season behaviors. So for a lot of birds, I'm interested in their songs, and they sing the most first thing in the morning. So they're basically waking up and saying, you know, hello, I'm here, this is my territory. And if they don't have a mate yet, they're trying to attract a mate, or they might be singing to their mate to make sure that they're still pair bonded, while also signaling to nearby males that this is my territory, don't come over here, or else, essentially. And so we have to get up early to record the songs. And so we have specialized microphones and recorders that we go out with to record the birds. And so typically we will record the bird, and if we haven't banded him yet, we'll band him immediately after. And so that means we put up what is called a mist net. It's this very fine net. It can be 6 to 12 meters, depending on what type of bird we're studying or what the habitat's like. And especially in the morning when it's kind of gray out still, it's hard for the birds to see it. So if we put that up on their territory and we play a song back at them, usually if they're territorial during the breeding season, they'll just kind of zoom right into the net. And then we have to quickly untangle them. That's a really fine motor skill that you have to be trained in. And then we put a U.S. Fish and Wildlife silver band on them, which if anyone else captures that bird again, they can look up the data on exactly where that bird was first captured, and we can figure out how old it is, etc. But we also put color bands on them so that we can see which individual is which. So, you know, they can probably tell each other apart, but to us, a white-crowned sparrow looks like a white-crowned sparrow. So we'll give one male on one territory might be like blue/blue/silver. And then the next male over might be red/green/yellow/silver. So they basically have these little acronym names based on the colors we put on their legs. And so we can just see them through the binoculars and say, oh, yep, he's still on his territory. Oh, yeah, he still has his female. Or, oh, look, a new female showed up, something like that. And we can track them throughout their whole breeding process. So we can look at things like their song. Do they find a mate? Do they have a successful nest? And, you know, look at other patterns like movement through noise or light. And yeah, just everything we can. We're looking at the full cycle of these birds during the breeding season.
And the band is like a little anklet?
Exactly, like a little bracelet or anklet. Mm-hmm. And the silver one is made out of metal, so that one lasts a really long time. The color ones are plastic, and sometimes they fade, but usually if that does happen, they get rid of that color. So I think they're all pretty long-term. They last the length of the bird's life. Some birds, like cardinals, which have really strong beaks, are able to sometimes pull off the color bands, but most of the time, they'll be on them for the rest of their lives.
Gosh, can you imagine being a bird and you're just living your bird life, and then all of a sudden you like get a bracelet and you're like, wow, that was a really weird morning.
Yeah, it is kind of like an alien abduction. So, you know, we do our best to just quickly capture them, take their measurements, and then release them. And, you know, when you're well-trained, you don't ever have any injuries or anything. So it's pretty safe. But yeah, I'm sure they're like, what the heck just happened to me? They always kind of fluff up and look kind of angry afterwards. Like, well, who are you? And don't you ever come back?
And so then how would you measure their eyes? Do you have like little rulers?
So yeah, we have what we call calipers. So they're really fine scale. Kind of looks like if you had an extension on a wrench where you kind of can dial it down and it shows you the number as you're dialing it down. So we just place that what we call lateral eye size from the corner of each side of the eye to get that eye size. And so I guess another thing to say about that is these are field measurements. So we're just measuring what we can easily do in the field. So it could be that it's not the actual full eyeball size, that if there is evolution at work here, that might not be the full eye that's changing, but it could actually be the soft tissue around the eye. So like the opening of the eye, or it could be both.
Did you always know that you wanted to be a scientist?
I don't know if I always knew, but I always loved science and animals. I did have a book, So You Want to Be a Zoologist. So I kind of, I don't know how old I was when I got that book, but I think that did influence me pretty strongly. I knew I wanted to work with animals. I just didn't know in what capacity. And I don't think you really know about research or kind of wildlife ecology type of jobs until you get to college. I took a class that was called Animal Behavior and Communication, and that really was a spark for me, because before then, people would just say, oh, you like animals, you should be a vet. But I didn't really want to work with sick animals. I wanted to understand animals and what they do in their daily lives out in the wild. So I think the communication aspect was really interesting to me because I love music. I was a band nerd in high school. So that musical element of birdsong was attractive. And I never was a bird watcher growing up. But once I studied abroad in Costa Rica and got to see how diverse birds were, and, you know, there's kind of bigger and brighter birds, you know, that are more obvious if you're a newbie, that kind of really got me thinking about birds and birdsong and noise pollution in general.
Do you have a favorite thing or a favorite fact about birds as a group or about any kind of bird?
Ooh, that's hard. So, oh my gosh. So birds in their syrinx, they can do two things at once. So I guess that's a good bird song fun fact, right? The reason their vocalizations can be so complex is they're basically like circular breathing and producing multiple tones at once if they want to, depending on what their song's like.
What is a syrinx?
So the syrinx is like the voice box of the bird.
What's the best part of your job?
I think just being in the field when you're just being quiet and still and seeing the birds act in their natural way, it's just very peaceful. And I find that very satisfying. And you feel like when you observe a behavior that, you know, these animals, they're not freaking out. They don't see you. They're acting normal. You feel like you're a spy or something, but you're seeing something special when you're seeing these courting behaviors or songs. It's just like a sneak peek into a different world, and it feels very special.
Do you have any advice for kids who are interested in being scientists when they grow up?
Yeah, I think my advice would be just keep asking questions. You know, we don't always have the answers, but asking questions and then thinking about, well, how can I find out if this is true or not? That's the step one of science. So for me, making an observation like a bird handing another bird an insect, it's like, well, why are they doing that? Oh, well, maybe it's because that's a male courting a female and that's a nuptial gift and he's trying to woo her. So just always be curious. And, you know, if you can't find an answer, then that's a great new study that could be done by you someday.
That's all for this episode, friends. Big thanks to Jennifer Phillips of Washington State University. As always, if you've got a science question for me, you can submit it at askdruniverse.wsu.edu. That's askdruniverse.wsu.edu. Who knows where your questions will take us next?